Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hart Glass, and it's time for It's All About Food here on a lovely December 10th, 2013. We had a big snowfall this morning, but the sky now looks kind of clear. It's got clouds in it, but it's a good day. It's a little cold. It's time to put on a sweater, right? And talk about my favorite subject, food. And I want to jump in right away with my first guest because we're going to have a lot to talk about this first part of the show. And that is Ben Falk. He is the author of a book called The Resilient Farm and Homestead, an Innovative Permaculture and Whole Systems Design Approach with Practical Information on Landscaping, Water Security, Perennial Crops, Soil Fertility, Nutrient-Dense Food, and more. He developed whole systems design as a land-based response to biological and cultural extinction and the increasing separation between people and elemental things. Life as a designer, builder, ecologist, tree tender, and backcountry traveler continually informs Ben's integrative approach to developing landscapes and buildings. His home landscape and the whole systems design studio site in Vermont's Mad River Valley serve as a proving ground for the regenerative land developments featured in the projects of the whole system design. He has studied architecture and landscape architecture at the graduate level and holds a master's degree in land use planning and design and has conducted nearly 200 site development consultations across New England and facilitated dozens of courses on permaculture design, property selection, microclimate design, and design for climate change. We need you, Ben Falk. Welcome to It's All About Food. Ben, are you with us? Oh, where are you, Ben? Okay. Let's see. Well, I can talk a lot about what's going on with the book, but first I want to know where he is. Where is Ben? Okay. Well, in the meanwhile, I just got this book literally yesterday, and I have been devouring it. And, you know, you probably know this already, but what I like to do on this show is I like to focus on things that are inspirational, empowering. And we hear so much in the news today about things that are scary, things that are violent, things that are destroying this planet. And that's not what we do here. We talk about things that are inspirational and empowering, and I believe Ben is back, so I'm going to bring him on. Welcome to It's All About Food. Are
Hi,
you with us,
how
Ben?
You doing?
Hi. Good. Well, I just had a little introduction, and I'm glad to have you. I got your book yesterday, and I was really happy to get it because, as I was just mentioning, we hear so much bad about what's going on in the world today, and what I like to talk about on this show in particular and in my life in general are the positive things, the solutions, things that we can do. And clearly you have come up with an approach that works for you that I think a lot of us can learn from and get excited about.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's definitely works for me very well and is something that's increasingly drawing a lot of interest from people all over as possibilities.
Well, and it's necessary because this is definitely the direction we need to go in. We've been going in a very interesting direction the last couple of hundred years, and a lot of us are saying that we can't continue in that direction. But what's exciting to read about in your book is we can make significant positive changes more quickly than was suspected in improving our topsoil and the strength and fertility of the land, and this is really exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's the kind of the prospects for regeneration, you know, meaning the ability, as you say, the ability that we have to heal landscapes and to bring health back into land and into ourselves as well and communities as a result. It's surprising how quickly and deeply we can do that, and that's kind of the best news that I've ever come across in my life.
It really is great news. Now, I wanted to say before we dig into this book a little bit that I really enjoy your writing. It's somewhat poetic, and there's a spiritual voice there, and just made it very pleasurable reading, while at the same time I'm realizing this work is not romantic. It's not easy. It's challenging. But there was something that resonated with me in terms of, I just kept saying, yes, 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 this is good. This is where we need to be going.
Yeah, well, thank you. I kept telling myself when I was writing the book that it's not fiction. It doesn't have to be great literature. It doesn't need to be great writing. I'm just trying to share information. So that's a nice surprise.
It is good writing. It is definitely very good writing, and it's very honest and it's very true. But there was just some really lovely energy that I was feeling coming out of the book. Okay.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe what comes across is just the lifestyle and the direct contact that I have with the land and with the systems that I'm trying to share. Maybe that just comes through because I'm not a particularly great writer, I don't think.
Well,
so
that, it could good. Be also that I love the outdoors, and I live in New York City, so I don't have an opportunity to get my hands dirty very often, and I like reading about it. Where I know other people, some people in my family in particular, who stay far away from dirt and probably would not enjoy reading much about it. some initial philosophy we read about in the beginning of the book that kind of permeates is this concept. Some of it in response to what's plaguing our society today, where all businesses, all lifestyles these days seem to focus on short-term, quick fixes, quick income, with a disrespect and no regard to the long-term, and we are really suffering for that. And it sounds like from what you've developed, there is a way to, with planning, with intelligence, to benefit in the short term while planning for the long term.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's very accurate. And I think we've learned that directly from the work here on our land, and seeing how the land responds and how plants grow and how animals grow as well, and just how the whole land system responds. But also, I mean, that lesson, I think, is available when we look at other cultures and historically as well, and see how people when we look at examples of how people have tended to their places in their own lives in a way that is good for the hundreds of years and the many, many generations, usually we find people that weren't suffering day to day because they lived that way. Usually just the opposite. Actually, I can't think of an example when people weren't tending to the ages with their daily work that their daily lives were terrible because of that. It's always been just the opposite. So it's funny. I think there's this kind of myth that if we just snatch up everything we can for the short term, well, at least the near term will be great. And actually, it's kind of just the opposite. Not only is the long term not tended to, but the short term is usually very dissatisfying and unhealthy and destructive as well.
We have a lot of depressed people on the planet right now. And I think it's because of this disconnect that we have with nature.
Yeah, it doesn't seem too surprising. I think when you really dig into it, it's kind of like, how could we not be so depressed? And, in the kinds of daily interactions with our sustenance sources and the basics of what we need to live the way they are today.
Okay, so you're talking about permaculture in this book. Can you just give a brief explanation of what that is for people who may not be that familiar with it?
Sure. There's a lot of ways to define permaculture, but for me, the way that I use the term is simply a life system. It's more than just gardening and growing food, although that's a big part of it, but a life sustaining situation, a lifestyle, and also the way we're connected to community and economy as a result, that where we are modeling our actions and the design of our systems on how nature has evolved and how nature works. And we're, for instance, getting our sustenance, let's say growing food, as a result of tending to ecosystems and getting food as almost a side yield of of a system. Not it's very different than, let's say, you have an acre, 10-acre field, and you say, I want to grow these three crops, and everything else we want to remove and destroy because we just want the three crops. And in permaculture, you say, what ecosystem is meant, what ecosystem does best here? You look around at the most natural sites you can find in that climate, in that area, and you decide, okay, how can we garner yields for ourselves out of that ecosystem, which wants to live here anyway? So it's very much working with nature as much as possible, never working against. So you really start to glean yields, food, fuel, medicine, fiber, whatever it is you may need, almost as a, we think of it as side yields, as side benefits of a system that's working on its own anyway. And so it's very different even than in organic farming. In an organic farm, it's still, we want these 10 or 20 crops. Let's destroy every other living thing that's there to get these crops. And we may, you know, not use particularly toxic materials to do that in an organic farm, but it's still in no way working with how the natural system wants to function and evolve over time in that place, which is usually forest-based. It's usually tree-based, and that's why permacultures are so into tree crops and having trees be at the center of the system. If you think about most landscapes in most of the world, they revert to a tree, a forested system over time. That's the most stable and arguably the most robust, healthy ecosystems over time. So we want to figure out how to fit within that, how to fit our food and other systems within the model of a forest.
This philosophy of permaculture, it really can be applied to all things. It seems like many of us try to control so many things around our lifestyle, the relationships we have, and when we learn to accept what is and work with something or someone rather than against them, things can really thrive. And it's the same with
absolutely.
The land. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where permaculture really is. We always have to remind ourselves, not a system of just growing food, although that's where you see it manifested most fully. It's really an approach that can be taken to all aspects of life. And it's one of those approaches that, like you're describing, when it's realized, that the beauty of it is very, very simple, but it's also such a radical thing to do, even though it sounds so basic, like let's just, work with systems around us as they want to manifest themselves naturally anyway. It's so basic of an idea, but it's also, it looks so radical in practice.
I mean, it's radical in our times today, in our industrialized corporate related times, but it wasn't radical centuries ago.
No, exactly. It's very telling of how far we are removed from the way living systems want to work for us to realize to feel that it is radical. Absolutely.
You mentioned tree crops. I want to talk a little bit about trees. Trees are always undervaluated when people look at the cost or return on investment of building a business or doing something and they have to cut down trees. They never include the real value of trees. And at one point in the book, you compared the return on investment of planting a tree to an IRA account.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we don't, I wanted to break down that value just in very straight, baseline monetary terms, and realized as I was doing it, which I should say with the help of my father, who knows how to calculate compounded interest and do all the numbers I ran through there, I realized that just as a purely economic instrument, what trees do and the way they accrue value over time and the interest they bear, they're highly lucrative economic devices. I mean, I forget the numbers off the top of my head, but you might have them there in front of you. The net yield return on investment over time, it's very, very high from trees and from forests.
Well, it was a great comparison and just a frame of reference that people aren't used to thinking about, which is where we need to be going, really realizing the value of what is given to us just on this earth, that if we could only respect and nurture, we would be a lot richer.
Absolutely.
In so many ways.
Yeah, and trees are just, you know, kind of one example of the larger way that we are trying to learn how to look at working with living systems in general, which is that, you know, the idea of working and living off of the interest, not mining the principle. And that's, and to put in economic terms, that's all we're trying to do in permaculture is live off the interest, live off the solar, you know, the current solar gain, as some people might put it, not, you know, dig down and mine the ancient sunlight in the form of fossil fuels. That's mining the principle. And we know anyone, economics, you know, home economics 101 knows you mine your principal in your bank account and you have nothing to bear interest. You've mined the bedrock of your foundation. So that's all we're trying to do.
Now, how did you come upon this piece of land? You have about 10 acres and you've had it for a little over a decade. And the way you describe it, it was not the nicest piece of property you could start with.
Yeah, it was, in some ways, it's the perfect piece of property for us to start with that we realize in retrospect. But absolutely, if you're looking to just grow food, you know, it's not the kind of piece of land you'd pick. It has, you know, it's basically clay and gravelly, silty soils, and boulders. You know, it's not agricultural soil. It's not the kind of land that we grow food on nowadays, certainly at the farm scale. And it's sloping, it's steep. We drop about a couple hundred feet in a pretty short distance. But that ended up being is a kind of the perfect backdrop for figuring out how to evolve the food system as a whole and also our lifestyle as a result. Because really what this landscape is, the 10 acres that I have, is it's actually like most of the planet. It's a lot more like most of the planet than, you know, deep soil agricultural land. That's just a very small proportion of the planet where actually we garner most of our food right now. So it was a great model to work with, because most of the land we have to work with in the planet is in this degraded, poor soil, sloping, has those characteristics. So it's a great model, and it also then forces innovation because you just can't work with it like we think of using systems the way we grow food today. You can't just, you know, till rows with a tractor and plant annuals and do the typical food system. It just won't, that landscape that I live on just won't allow that. So it forces a certain creativity.
There's a lot of useful information in here, and what I like about it, and you even talk about your approach, is that you're not really telling people the specific details of what they need to do. You're talking about your experience, what you considered, what you did, but all the time you keep mentioning in here that the answer to most questions is it depends, because each piece of land, each climate is individual like we are.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very easy. I think the way we raise especially young people today and kind of the industrial mindset is we want a prescription, you know, quite literally and also figuratively. We want someone to tell us, you know, this, here's step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this is how you do it this way and you get this result. But, you know, landscapes aren't like that. They're all different. Every place has its own rules, and while there's patterns that carry from one place to another, and we teach those patterns in permaculture design courses, the details of each place are very different. And so what we have to understand is the patterns and how to ask the right questions and the overarching principles at work. And we all can discover and have to discover, you know, the details of how to go about solving the challenges in front of us in our own places, which are as there's as many answers as there are places. And that's so fascinating and exciting and empowering, because we all have to become our own experts on the place that we live. You know,
Be your own expert and start trying stuff. I like how you said that.
Absolutely. It's a really empowering view. I think we can all be empowered by that view.
Now, I was really fascinated that you're growing rice on your property in Vermont.
Yeah.
When I think about rice, I think about California, which probably isn't a good place to be growing rice.
Well, it has a great climate for it, as for many crops. But Yeah, rice is just one of the many things that emerged, one of the many possible solutions that's emerged from us trying to fit into the place we live and trying to understand how to do well by the place, how to build soil fertility and hold water on site and not, dump the water off our site and, not degrade our soil and cause erosion. And in the meantime, how to get food, fuel, medicine, the basic needs of our lives from that landscape. So, in that attempt to fit ourselves to the land, making patties seem like a very good idea, because rice patties are just constructed wetlands that you can eat out of. They're just edible stormwater detention basins. And we know the value of slowing water down and retaining it in things like wetlands, that they're crucial. And here's a system that you can actually also grow food in. So then I heard you could actually, there's a couple rice strains that are short enough season to try in this very short season climate that we're in the mountains of Vermont. So we gave it a go, and it's definitely viable. We've helped to prove, along with a few other farms, that it's viable. Although ours was really the first significant rice patties in as cold of a climate as we are in the North America, at least. There's probably, a handful of years ago when we started, there was no one else growing rice in as cold of a place. Now there is, so we know it's possible, but when we started, we really didn't know, and it is, and rice is a great staple crop. You can store it for a long time, and so it's a valuable thing. It's one of the only annual agricultural crops that the world has ever figured out how to grow in a truly sustainable and perpetual way for not just hundreds of years, but for thousands of years on the same piece of land. Most of the time when we grow annuals, we destroy the place within short order, a few hundred years or less. But there are rice patties in Asia that have been in continuous use for 4,000 years.
They've been able to
perpetuate the fertility in those systems.
Well, I love reading about it, and the pictures that you have are really beautiful. And it's not only beneficial from what you're reaping from it, but the landscape with the ponds in it surrounded by the trees and the other foliage is stunning.
Yeah, they're really beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Definitely.
I wanted to mention, when I first started reading the book, I was thinking, I wonder if you read Helen and Scott Nearing's The Good Life, and certainly you listed it in the appendix. That was a story that came out in the Depression where a couple, and they were in their 50s, I think, when they got started. They both had good jobs that they lost, and then they decided to make a go of it with farming and survive and thrive by making their own food. And it was a lovely story. I loved reading it. And yours is, I don't know what your motivation was to do this. I don't think yours was necessarily the same, but it's a similar theme.
Yeah. Yeah. I had certainly read the Nearings, not all their books, but at least Living the Good Life in college. And that was, definitely one of the key turning points for me in realizing what I could do with my own life was reading their book in probably freshman and sophomore year in college. My motivations were similar and different. I think they were probably more similar than they were different. But, I also wanted to live in a beautiful, quiet place where I could see the stars and not constantly listen to the drone of just human creations, but also of songbirds and, the wind and the snow coming down and all of the other, million things that nature offers us. But also just take some of my own existence into my own hands a lot more. It was also somewhat accidental. I was going to graduate school for architecture, and it happened to be near that school, this piece of land. And the idea wasn't that I was going to live there and homestead forever. But it was actually, that was in the back of my mind. I knew I wanted to do that someday, but the way I ended up on this particular piece of land was a little more accidental than that. I thought that part of my life was going to come later, and it actually came sooner than it might have.
Well, it seemed accidental to you, but I'm sure the universe had it in its plan.
Yeah, and probably a little always more at work than we realize, that's for sure.
Right. Now, do you have any recommendations for those of us who live in an urban environment?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of great work being done in urban places, you know, in urban permaculture and, you know, groups like the Guerrilla Gardeners in New York City doing a lot of stuff. It's not what I focus on personally, obviously, because I live in such a rural place.
Mm-hmm.
But there's great resources out there as far as what you can do. I mean, you can grow a whole bunch of food in very small spaces, especially if you get really vertical and, you know, use a lot of trellising and vine crops and work in the vertical element. You can even do a lot of stuff on a balcony, but you do need some space. You do need some sunshine to do a lot of things. But that being said, there's people growing all sorts of food and also just kind of reclaiming some of their own basics with water systems and some of their food systems in really small spaces. You know, it's not just food, obviously. I talk about it in the book. There's some energy systems. But, you know, as far as really reclaiming a lot of these basics and kind of taking stock and creating more resilient, an overall more resilient lifestyle that includes food, energy, medicine, water systems, heating systems. You just have more options to do that where you have some space and in a more rural or at least suburban area. You know, the more we depend on and are locked into municipal systems, you know, oftentimes the less options we have, you know, at our disposal to work with. But there's a lot of great work being done on that front.
You talk about replenishing your soil, and you go into really nice detail with images on how you replenish certain areas, increasing your topsoil really quickly in an area that had relatively nothing because of the abuse that had been done on this land for so long. And that was really inspiring. I was kind of entertained or amused to read about how much you encourage urinating outdoors and the benefit of doing so on plants because of the nutrition that they get. Makes sense.
Absolutely. We're getting all our nutrients from the food we eat. You know, they got to go back somewhere.
We're really uptight these days about being sterile, and it's impacting us in so many ways, and now we're discovering all these autoimmune diseases that people are getting is linked to the fact that we're not connected to the healthy bacteria. And there was a story recently that came out that the Amish don't have some of these autoimmune diseases because they've got barns with animals and manure lying around, and all this bacteria in the air is beneficial for us. And
right.
Not having
Absolutely.
It is not good.
Yeah, we've actually had more than one client move to rural Vermont, and we've helped them, you know, find land and develop their systems. One of their motivations was that their kids were becoming kind of sickly, and they had kind of some understanding that it was a result of, you know, literally not having enough dirt in their life, not having enough exposure to living systems, and developing enough of a robust immune system, and actually, they've all experienced a serious improvement in the situation in their kids who had, like, were becoming allergic to this, that, and the other thing from a, kind of the overly sterile existence that, you know, we're used to. And they keep farm animals now and have a lot more health on that front.
Yep. And the last thing I want to talk about is water. And you like to call this place we live in Planet Water, instead of Planet Earth.
Sure. It's you know, it's really what defines our existence on kind of all sides. We're bounded by what water provides, and it certainly is what makes this planet different than all the others out there. As far as we know, I mean, water is the beginning, it's kind of start and end point of all of life processes. So, and also the neat thing is, if you get on top of managing your water, you, by virtue of doing that, you're managing your soil. You know, when there's an erosion problem on a piece of land, it's not just a function of the soil. First, it's a function of the water, where the water takes the soil. You know, the water is the medium that moves everything. and the universal solvent is what holds everything. So, and it holds a lot of fertility as well. So what we've learned through growing rice especially and through some other crops is that if we can flow spread and sink water on our site, if we can retain as much water as we can on our site, which is the opposite of what most of 20th century civil engineering is thought to do, which is get it out of here, get it, you know, remove it, put it in the oceans, basically. We can actually increase our fertility, increase the production of the land, the actual performance of the systems, as well, while reducing flooding and kind of negative impacts off site, which result from shunting water off of land, you know, while reducing and basically eliminating erosion and causing some other major improvements in the system. So it really, it starts and ends with water.
We have a lot of re-education to do, re-educating to do. And
we do.
For many of us who have no idea where our food comes from outside of a supermarket, some of the people are lucky enough to go to farmers markets, but aside from that, most of us have no idea what it takes to grow our food. And don't forget, you know, next to air, which we cannot live without, we can't live without food and water. And it's so important for our survival. And I think just reading a book like this can help get us more connected with the appreciation of what it takes and to do it sustainably and in balance. So where can people find out? You give courses, too. Where can people find out more about you and what you know? Oh, I think we just lost you, unfortunately. Okay, so I'm going to look here on my website, wholesystemsdesign.com. Whole, W-H-O-L-E, system, designs, wholesystemsdesign.com. You could link from my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and find out more about Ben Falk and his business. There's lots of wonderful information there, videos. They have workshops. And this book is lovely. I really enjoyed reading it. And I think whether you're interested in farming and buying land and creating a farm or just having a garden, there's a lot of wonderful information here. It's common sense, but, you know, we've been kind of encouraged not to think simply and in balance with nature, and I got a lot out of it. Well, I'm sorry that I can't say officially goodbye, Ben, but I enjoyed speaking with you, and let's take a little break, okay? So you've been listening to It's All About Food, and we're going to be back in a moment with Steve Meyerowitz, the Sprout Man. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And now we're going to talk a little bit more about food, because that's what we do here, right? And that's why you're listening. So now, for some of us urban folks and not so urban folks, if you want to grow some food easily, we're going to talk about how to do that right now. And I'm going to bring on Steve Meyerowitz, the Sprout Man. He's the author of several books on health, diet, and nutrition, including Sprouts, the Miracle Food, Sprout Man's Kitchen Garden Cookbook, and Wheatgrass, Nature's Finest Medicine. He's one of the world's leading proponents of sprouting, juicing, fasting, wheatgrass, indoor gardening, raw foods, and pure water. His website is sproutman.com. Welcome, Sprout Man, to It's All About Food.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Karen.
Thank you. You know, I talked to you a few years ago. It's been quite a while, and I really enjoyed that conversation, although it put me back a few dollars because after talking to you, I got one of those Tribus sprouters, and I've been using it ever since. So I'm wondering, what is this show going to cost me?
Well, the price, good health is priceless.
Yes. There you go.
And the same with quality food. And those of us who live in the Northeast, we're now in December. It's a tough time to get fresh food with the vitality that we got used to over the summer.
Yes, it is.
So, you know, my concept really is one of the few ways, and certainly the most inexpensive way, to bring springtime into the homes of Northeasterners and Northerners everywhere in the middle of December.
Springtime for Northeasterners in December.
Has a ring to it.
I was
let's
just...
go in. Let's produce it.
Right. Yeah, there we go. Let's put on a show and grow sprouts. Well, the one thing that I enjoyed when I got my Tribes sprouter was that I was able to grow sunflower sprouts, which are my ultimate favorite kind, and I never thought that I could without dirt.
Yes, yes. You know, it's very interesting, but these baby plants mature. We eat them at the seedling stage, so they're only about a week old, give or take. And at that stage, the roots are not mature enough to go into the soil and convert the minerals there into an organic form that the plant can uptake. So therefore, the soil provides a structural bed for the plant, but doesn't actually provide all those minerals until later on when the roots are much longer. And, you know, that's what happens when you plant outdoors and the root systems really go down deep. And that's why outdoor gardening plants mature in like 90 days on average. And we only grow them for approximately 7 days. So, you know, the plants that we grow get most of their nutrition from the seed itself and from the water by osmosis. So the quality of the water is important. Mm-hmm. But actually, these plants are so concentrated at this early stage of their life that the nutrition in them is anywhere from 50 to 100 times more concentrated than it is for the mature outdoor vegetable, even if it's organically grown. So we don't have to worry so much about the nutrition or even the quality of water, although I recommend to everyone that we use water that you feel is suitable for drinking. But that aside, growing in your kitchen, in an apartment building, you don't want to get involved in soil and all that extra, all the extra steps that are involved in bringing it in and taking it out and composting. And gosh, when I started out, Dr. Ann Wigmore, who was one of my mentors, one of the people who inspired me, she had us working compost buckets in our kitchens with worms in them.
Mm-hmm. Which many people today don't want to have anything to do with. Worms, ooh.
Well, she got, you know, she got the diehards, she got the devotees, she got the people who were too sick to do anything else but follow her word by the letter. But
yeah,
it's not necessary. If you, if you're going to grow alfalfa sprouts in water, then you can also grow wheatgrass in water and sunflower and buckwheat, all of the microgreens, because some of these things that I promote for growing can grow 10 to 12 inches tall, like the pea shoots and the sunflowers and the buckwheat and the wheatgrass. Those are all called microgreens because they're so tall and big.
Oh, should I be growing them 12? Should I be growing them 12 inches tall?
Well, that depends on the quality of the seed because and the time that you use. So, if you're going to grow for 7 inches or 8 inches or you're going to need more like 8 days to 10 days,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to need the warmer weather, and you're going to need, you know, good quality seed.
Okay. But it's okay to do that.
It's actually great.
Yeah.
You know, the microgreens take a few days longer. So that's why I say 7 days a week, give or take. The microgreens are more like 10 days on average. Wheatgrass I like to grow for 12 days. That's pretty long.
Now, what, how do you recommend harvesting them, and what do you do with the roots?
Well, the roots on the microgreens can get too chewy. So we have a situation where they're so chewy, they're not delectable anymore. So what we do is we cut them off at the just above the roots, so you're only eating the shoots. Mm-hmm. And the shoots for pea shoots, I like to dice up so that they're crispy and crunchy in a salad. And I dice up the sunflowers as well, even though they're more delicate.
Okay. And do you just get rid of the roots?
I
do.
Do
you eat them? Do you ever eat them?
I add them to my compost, and the roots are certainly clean enough to eat. They're just a little more fibrous.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if the plants are not that healthy, the root systems are not that clean.
Mm.
So it's good to cut above. That's what we do when we harvest outdoors. We cut above the roots when we cut at the ground level. So, you know, that's perfectly fine to do even in a no-soil environment. But otherwise, when we're talking about the baby greens, like alfalfa and clover, radish, broccoli, cabbage, kale, all of those, you can eat the roots and all, because the roots are very thin, very tender, and you just want to rinse them clean so there's no shells on them. And those roots are very edible. They're not so fibrous like the microgreens.
Okay, now I have one of these, as I mentioned before, these Tribus sprouter that you plug in and it automatically waters all day, which makes it a lot easier. But I don't have anything stacked, and I see that you can stack a few on top of each other. And how does that work?
Well, you know, it's sort of crop rotation gardening, so that, you know, let's say I start on Monday and I start with alfalfa, and then it grows for a few days, and on Thursday I decide I want to plant some broccoli. So alfalfa would move up to the top position because it's now 4 days old and it's ready to start getting some light, and the broccoli is just starting out. It can go on the bottom level.
That's
how we would stagger the maturity time. So they'll all mature every few days. You'll get a crop.
Right. Okay. Well, I just may have to get a few more of these to stack on top.
Yes.
We
just came. There's the more money you were worried about.
Right. Okay. Now, there's a conference coming up I heard about in New York, and you're a part of that. Can you tell me about that?
Yes.
I got
yes.
an email about that.
Yes, the real truth about health.
The real truth about health.
Yes, that's what it's called. And they've got a dozen speakers, including Sherry Soria and Brian Clement and myself, and several other bright lights in the health, diet, and nutrition world. And I think you should be there, Karen.
You do? Okay. Well, maybe I will.
But it's at the Millennium Hotel on 42nd Street. And, you know, it's just one of those good gatherings. And if you don't happen to live in the New York City area, you can attend by live streaming.
Live streaming is good. Yeah, I'm just looking at the names of the people that are going to be there, and I've talked to most of them on this show, a lot of my favorites.
Yeah.
Dr. Clement
yeah.
and Jeffrey Smith and Richard Oberlander, who's going to be here in January, and Michael Greger is going to be on the show in January, and Sherry and Dan, Sherry Soria and Dan Letterman.
Yeah.
I haven't seen them in a decade.
Yeah,
I'm sure they're looking good because they're fueled on raw foods, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of us who've been proponents of living foods for a long time, you know, and mostly, I think it's partially in opposition to all the canned and frozen and boxed food that has become a staple of the American diet. You know, I call it corporate food. And
yep.
the corporations have really overwhelmed the availability of food and kind of de-emphasized the fresh food, you know, and de-emphasized the kitchen time, spending time in your kitchen preparing food versus the fast food or the prepared foods, like the frozen foods. So, you know, I think we've got our priorities upside down.
Absolutely. Well, I can hear Jack LaLanne shouting out from wherever he is in the afterlife, if man made it, don't eat it. And then there's me, who's always saying, find your kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
Find your kitchen.
I think we were all healthier back in our grandparents' kitchen when food was prepared and we ate fresh. We ate it from grandma. We didn't eat it from a box or a can. And that makes a difference in our health. And I think, you know, we can see the results of corporate food when you look at the cardiovascular disease, the cancer, the diabetes, the obesity. You know, that's the result of corporate food.
Okay, a couple of things about Sprouts. Now, some people are nervous about eating Sprouts because there's been some bad press about it. Can you educate us on what we should or should not be concerned
sure.
about? There were too many negatives in there, I think, but I think you understand what I'm asking.
yeah, there's been some food safety scares because of salmonella and E. coli, and those things, you know, make a lot of bad press. And sadly, the sprouting industry is a poor industry. Unlike the, you know, meat and poultry, they can't stand up they don't have PR, and they can't stand up in the press and defend themselves. But, you know, here's the thing to know about salmonella and E. coli. They originate in the intestines of pigs and cows and sheep. This is not something that originates with a fruit or a vegetable. It's, you know, tomatoes don't come with salmonella, even though there has been an outbreak with tomatoes, and spinach doesn't come, and sprouts don't come that way. We don't generate these pathogens. However, we can be contaminated by them. So, you know, even if a farmer, you know, gets it on his shoe and he walks into a truck and that truck is distributing vegetables as well as meats, you know, there is cross-contamination. So contamination can also have the seed can get contaminated. And so in the sprout industry, we're very careful to test everything. If you were to visit my website on seeds, you would see that I test everything as lab tested. I test for the quality of seed, too, because I want to make sure when you're growing my sprouts, you're going to get really tall, green, delicious sprouts and with high germination counts. But I also send them out to the lab to test for salmonella in E. coli, and we'd actually take samples. It's actually a little flute-like pole that goes into the bag, and we twist it and pull it out, and we've sampled that entire bag because it's about a 22-inch flute. And we do that with every bag, and then we grow all of that stuff, and we test the rinse water from the growing of those sprouts. And that's what's lab tested. And they say that's 99.9%. There is no such thing as 100% guarantee when we're talking about microbiology.
Right. Now, there are companies out there like Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta that are manipulating our seeds in ways that some people don't think is a very good idea, genetic modification, and they're buying up a lot of seed companies. So are there any safe seeds out there?
Yes. Thankfully, we still have a certified organic movement. And there's also a smaller non-GMO certification. And if you look at my seeds, you'll see I sell strictly certified organic seeds. And that is really the only guarantee, that and the non-GMO certification, that our seeds come from that kind of source.
And Monsanto hasn't tried to buy up your source?
Well, yes, Monsanto has tried to buy up more and more fields, and they try to take control. And it's elevating, artificially increasing the price of seed everywhere because there's fewer and fewer farms where we can grow organic seed. So it's having a bad effect overall, and I think it's really misguided. I think it's dangerous, and, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, we might find out, we might have the proof of the dangers of genetic modification. But at this point, it's a struggle to keep our seeds safe and to keep the original seeds intact to protect.
So how many, I don't know how to measure it, pounds, ounces of sprouts do you grow a week?
Well, I can give you some numbers. 1 pound of alfalfa seeds, for example, will yield a minimum of 10 pounds of greens.
Mm.
That's alfalfa greens. And if you think about
that. That's a lot
of
greens.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you think of a head of lettuce, that's about 3/4 of a pound.
Mm-hmm.
So on average. So when I put 6 tablespoons of seeds in the sprouting tray of my Fresh Life sprouter, that will yield approximately 3/4 of a pound of greens. So, you know, alfalfa greens or clover greens or broccoli or kale, I mean, these are all just baby leaves. So instead of having one large leaf, say, from romaine lettuce, I'm having hundreds of these baby leaves, and they're much more delicate and really delicious. The flavors are very pronounced. Broccoli is a much more pronounced flavor of broccoli. Radish is a very pronounced radish flavor. Radish lovers just love it. I can grow chives, which have a really garlicky flavor to them. So there's all of these wonderful flavors and tastes, and when you think about it, a pound of alfalfa seed is approximately $10. So if you grow 10 pounds from it, then that's a cost of $1 a pound for your organic greens. And, you know, what can you buy at the produce stand that's organic that costs only $1 a pound?
Nothing, and it's not as fresh as growing it at home.
Sadly, that's the sad truth, because at this time of year, if you live in the Northeast where, you know, you and I do, you know, you've got to bring in these greens from the Salinas Valley of California, and it takes several days before it actually makes it to the East Coast wholesale markets, and then it takes a couple of days before your market purchaser, you know, brings it in. And they don't always put it out the first day they get it in, because they want to get rid of the last shipment first. So, you know, they'll put it out. But when do you and I actually arrive there? But when we buy it, it may already be a week old. So it's lost some of that vitality that I've mentioned before. And we need that vitality for our health.
And the sprouts have more nutrition in them. They're concentrated nutrition, like broccoli sprouts. We know how healthy broccoli is, but concentrated broccoli sprouts are like powerhouses.
Right, right. Well, the original research, and there's tons of research on this. If you open up my book, Sprouts the Miracle Food, you can see all of the university research. I mean, lots of it. If you just Google, well, actually, you could go to my website on the blog and look at broccoli sprouts and cancer, or just Google broccoli sprouts and cancer, and you'll see all this research because broccoli sprouts, for example, that's just one of them, they produce approximately 50 to 100 times more of this anti-cancer enzyme called sulforaphane than mature organic broccoli contains, even if you were to grow it in your backyard. So these are basically seedlings, and as seedlings, they contain a higher concentration of nutrients. Because remember what I said earlier, they contain all the nutrition necessary in the seed for the development of a mature vegetable.
Well, concentrated broccoli sprouts, well, that was another kind of sprout that I had a hard time sprouting before, and I thought I needed to do it in dirt, and now I'm able to grow them in the Fresh Life sprouter. And when I went through my ovarian cancer experience back 7 years ago now, I took concentrated broccoli sprout supplements, but now that I can grow my own broccoli sprouts, I've got all of this great anti-cancer nutrition anytime I want it, which is a beautiful thing. And
you know,
we're at the end of the show, Steve, so I wanted to thank you for joining me. And if anybody's interested, they can find out more at sproutman.com. Check the events tab to find out about this Real Truth and Health conference coming up in January if you're in the New York area. And thank you, Steve.
All right. Let's keep thinking green all winter long.
That sounds good. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. I wanted to mention just in a few seconds, responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have a brand new design. Please visit my website soon and often, and let me know what you think. Info@realmeals.org is my email, and have a delicious week.